May it please the court, tell me if the sound is good or bad. I'm Jane Duker, and I represent Respond.
It could probably be a little closer
further.
Not much. There you go. Thanks.
First time in my life I've been accused of being too quiet. And I represent respondent cross appellants, so it's sort of a unique position to be arguing first, given that we prevailed in the trial court. But just to remind your honors, we're here because the city of St. Louis passed a minimum wage that contravened the state minimum wage. And while there are a lot of rabbit holes and machinations we could dive into in the procedure and the different ways that we get to the same conclusion, the conclusion nonetheless is employers, if they comply with state law, if this were to pass, or if this were found to be legal, employers in the city of St. Louis who comply with state law would be subject to criminal penalties, would be subject to things such as restitution, back pay, and other things to an employee. So while there are probably four different ways that you get there, that the city doesn't have the authority to do this, the bottom line is it prohibits, the ordinance prohibits something that is allowed by state law, which is a classic conflict. And that violates 7101, 010, and all of the minimum wage statutes. Then you get into some of the express prohibitions and preemptions that have been passed by the Missouri legislature. I know you discussed in the last case the constitutionality of 67-1571. That statute is not unconstitutional. The city of St. Louis had a bite at the apple in 2001 to declare that law invalid. The circuit court did hold that, but it was obiter dictum. I never say that right. And it was not necessary for that court's ruling because the court found that the minimum wage statute in 2001 also conflicted with 71010 and the minimum wage law. That case came all the way up to this court. And when AIM, who is also a party to this case, they appealed that ruling on the constitutionality of that preemption, and the case was briefed. It was argued in front of this court, and the interveners and the city agreed, said that no, AIM is not an aggrieved party. They cannot appeal this because they won at the trial court. And that language regarding, and that ruling regarding 67-1571 has no preclusive effect because it was not necessary for the judgment, so the appeal should be dismissed. This court agreed. In their briefing, you really don't see anything about that. They act like they were not there when all of this happened. And so we believe that they are barred by the statute of limitations and by latches now, 16 years later, coming back and asking that statute be declared unconstitutional again. And
I know you're aware of the difference between filing something seeking to hold it unconstitutional or hold the statute invalid and using it as a defense, if you could address that.
Yes, and I think the cases where this court has ever extended that ability to an affirmative defense is when the party at issue actually is in some sort of danger of having sort of liability or having some statute applied against them that puts them either in criminal liability or even in significant civil liability. That's not the case here. This isn't an affirmative defense in the sense they just want to do something illegal. It isn't where they are going to be subjected to any sort of liability or any sort of, money judgment or any, they just want to do something they're not authorized to do. And I don't think this court has ever extended the affirmative defense in that circumstance. And we don't think that that's appropriate in this case. And so that, and everyone agrees that if 67-1571 is good law, that that's an express preemption. And the legislature spoke again when it passed HB 722. And that one even went further. I know there's a lot of discussion that 722 somehow evidences a legislative intent that they didn't have, that 67-1571 was unconstitutional. And the court generally doesn't engage in those sort of legislative intent kind of arguments because, one, that's not really recognized in Missouri, and two, it's at times impossible to understand the legislative intent. You always look at the words of the statute. Well, 722 goes further than 67-1571. In fact, 67-1571 says you cannot enact a minimum wage in excess of the state's. 722 says you can't enact one at all. So, and I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, It was obvious at this time that the cities were not really paying attention to the first prohibition, and so I think the legislature passed a second one and basically said, you're out of the minimum wage business completely.
And there's nothing that precludes the legislature from adopting more than one statute that says the same thing?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think they can reassert sort of what they believe. And I think it's interesting because some of the conflict here is whether the city decides whether something is of a general policy for the statewide as a whole versus the city deciding on its own whether something would be a statewide general policy, and I think it's the legislature.
There are numerous other statutes as opposing council, and Amici pointed out, that refer to or local minimum wage laws. Why would they do that if the legislature intended to preclude any other legislation, any local legislation, and occupy the field?
Well, the 722 does refer, because there is a right now.
I'm talking about the...
There's one other one that that briefly refers to a local, and I don't think that that's inconsistent with what we're saying, because the city has a minimum wage right now ordinance that actually is legal under state law. And what it is when the city, as a contracting party with vendors and people who receive city funds, when they enter into contracts with these people, they say you have to pay a certain wage.
But I thought the state occupied the field.
Well, I mean, you raise a very good point.
Parts of the field.
Yes. So you're raising the different, they conflate express preemption and then occupy the field. They're two separate analyses.
No, it's a conflict you're talking about. Nobody says there's express. Conflict versus occupying.
Conflict versus occupying the field. I think occupying the field is a little more of a gray area. I believe that most of the field is absolutely occupied, especially when it comes to contracting parties, when it comes to third parties.
It's clear, though, that the field is occupied where it's not express. And if some of the field is occupied and not other parts of the field, isn't that by definition not very clear that there's preemption?
I mean, I guess if you look at the spectrum, you look at, like, for example, the PSC. I mean, that is full regulatory, utility, banking. Those are highly regulated. I think most would agree on that side of the spectrum, that is full preemption. I think this is somewhere beneath that. I think, frankly, the sort of conflict is so apparent that you don't even need to reach the confusing issue as to where on the spectrum this would apply, because the conflict is so apparent.
How is there conflict if it's okay for the city to have a higher minimum wage in its own dealing with contractors?
I don't believe in this case they are allowed to have their own minimum wage, a local minimum wage. They're allowed to have the one that they already had that they enacted in response to the last minimum wage battle. And that is what I believe was protected under 722 and was, quote, grandfathered. So that was, they weren't referencing any local minimum wage law. The legislature, I don't think from the intent of the bill, it's very clear that they didn't want everybody to rush and pass one between May and August. I think what they were trying to do was grandfather the existing activities that were going on in the city that were legal. So I do think that when you criminalize complying with state law, you hit a conflict. This isn't like supplementing. This is supplanting the state law. So, for example, if this were to go into effect, you could repeal the entire state law and there would be no difference in the city. That just shows you that it completely supplants the state law, and that's not what it's supposed to be. It's a state minimum wage. There can only be one minimum. Otherwise, if there's another minimum, one minimum goes away. So it's no longer minimum if it has to be higher.
Well, but your opponent argues that the state law sets the floor and that local laws can then go above it.
Well, but the problem is once you say that the minimum wage is higher, the lower minimum wage is gone. I mean, there's only one minimum.
It just means one's a state minimum, doesn't it, and the other's the city minimum. Why is it in conflict to say in the city the minimum is higher? It does not negate that statewide you have to pay.
Well, they're re-regulating the same conduct. A lot of the cases, like, you know, Klossmeyer and Stenson, I call them the milk case and the length of the car case. Both of those cases where if you criminalize complying with the state law, that's a conflict. I mean, you're prohibiting something that the state allows. So there, you can't, I mean...
The state doesn't, how does the silence of the state on whether or not some, how does the state authorize or prohibit localities from enacting minimum wages by saying on a state level, this is going to be our minimum? How does that have any preclusive effect? How does that say, and you cities cannot in your particular localities have a higher minimum wage? It doesn't negate that you can't pay less than what the state
can. Yeah, and we're assuming
there may be particular iterations, particular remedies that do come in conflict, but you're trying to strike it in its entirety.
Yes, and I don't think the state is silent. I think, first of all, if you assume the express sort of preemption, 67-1571 and then HB 722, if those didn't exist, I still think the state has spoken because they said this is the state's minimum wage. And so, an employer in the city of St. Louis cannot comply with both. He no longer gets to comply with the state minimum wage anymore because the city's is higher. So you're basically eradicating it anywhere there's a higher minimum wage. You're eradicating the state's
minimum wage. Why would that state recognize exceptions for, like, dealing with contractors and so forth if your argument is valid that just the enactment of a minimum wage in and of itself is inconsistent with allowing localities to have any other minimum wages?
Well, I actually think the legislature is the appropriate party that does decide that, and they have expressly said this is a statewide general policy, because if cities are allowed, I mean, we could have, I don't know, 4,000 different minimum wages. I mean, so not only, I think not only is that what the state has said, I think there's a very good reason for that, because you would have so many conflicting minimum wages. You have local governmental bodies that overlap each other.
But we're not dealing with, but why'd they have 67-1571 then? Why wasn't that surplusage? And 722 if the minimum wage itself was surplusage?
I mean, I think the state expressing its desire to have a statewide local policy is not unheard of, and I think, and I don't think that necessarily means that it's invalid. The 1561 said you could have a minimum wage as long as it does not exceed. They went further in 722 saying you're out of the business completely. So the state, I think, evolved, which they have the power to do. And I think that they have expressed on more than one occasion that this is a statewide issue, because you don't want conflicting minimum wages overlapping. Because if what the city is saying is true, then I think all cities would be able to do this, and all localities would be able to do this, and it would be a morass of mess. So I think my time is up right now.
Question?
Did anyone have?
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jamie Raymond on behalf of the City of St. Louis. This case is about three issues. First is the old preemption law, as we refer to it in our briefing, section 67.1571, unconstitutional. If it is unconstitutional, then the court gets to the question of the interpretation of the minimum wage law. That interpretation presents a fundamental question about who that law is designed to protect. Is it a statute of authorization for employers, or rather a statute of prohibition designed to protect employees? Finally, what is the impact of House Bill 722, regardless of its constitutionality, recognizing that local minimum wage ordinances in effect by August 28, 2015, shall not be preempted? We ask the court to hold that the minimum wage law is a statute of prohibition intended to protect employees, which does not preempt local ordinances that simply prohibit more. And as a result, the trial court's judgment on counts 1 and 3 should be reversed, and the judgment on the remaining counts should be affirmed. On the first issue, the constitutionality of Section 67, the trial court correctly ruled that the old preemption statute is unconstitutional and unenforceable. The unconstitutionality of that statute is so obvious, respondents haven't even attempted to defend it. Rather, they argue this court has no choice but to enforce a patently unconstitutional statute because the city is time-barred from raising the issue as an affirmative defense. The trial court correctly concluded that is a wrong position, and we've set forth all the reasons supporting that conclusion in our briefing. Unless the court has further questions about it, I'd like to move straight to the thrust of this case, which is the proper interpretation of the minimum wage law. The St. Louis City Ordinance in this case is entitled to a strong presumption of validity. Under the court's precedent, the ordinance should be construed to uphold its validity unless respondents who have the burden here can show that it is expressly inconsistent or an irreconcilable conflict with the laws of the state. The test, as this court set forth in the Cape Motor Lodge case, is whether the ordinance prohibits what the statute permits or permits what the statute prohibits. Here, the minimum wage law is a statute of prohibition intended to protect employees against employers. It sets a minimum wage floor and employers are prohibited from paying below. The ordinance is consistent with the minimum wage law because it also prohibits paying below the minimum wage floor, but currently sets that floor higher. This court has repeatedly recognized that local ordinances may supplement state law by prohibiting more. We cite a string of cases in our brief at page 39, including the Teefee case, which was just decided in 2000. Respondents attempt to create a conflict where there is none by reimagining the minimum wage law as a statute of authorization for employers to pay as little as the minimum and not a cent more. It's the wrong interpretation. This precise argument was evaluated by the Court of Appeals in the Carlson case just in 2009, and that case held that a statute that prohibits conduct does not serve to authorize unregulated conduct on the same topic unless the authorization is expressed in the statutory language or evident from the statutory intent. Here, there is no express statutory language in the minimum wage law authorizing anything. Rather, it just prohibits employers from paying below the minimum wage floor. If the court looks to the legislative intent, it's even more obvious. Just 2 years ago, in the Talentino case, this court looked at the intent of the minimum wage law and stated it's a remedial statute with the purpose of ameliorating the unequal bargaining power between employers and employees and to protect the rights of those who toil, of those who sacrifice the full measure of their freedom and talents for the use and profit of others. This court held the statute is designed to protect employees. The interpretation is only reinforced when you look at the complete statutory scheme. 8 years after the minimum wage law was passed, the General Assembly passed the old preemption statute, Section 67. If the minimum wage law already occupied the field and conflicted with local ordinances, there would be no reason 8 years after the law was passed for the General Assembly to pass an express preemption statute. And this court has held that one of the fundamental tenets of statutory construction is that it will not interpret statutes to be a meaningless act by the General Assembly. And that's exactly what 67 would be if you adopted respondents' interpretation of the minimum wage law. Not only that, but 25 years after the minimum wage law was passed, just last year, the General Assembly again passed another express preemption statute with House Bill 722. The same rationale applies here. There would be no reason for the General Assembly to pass not one, but two preemption statutes if, as respondents suggest, in 1990, 25 years earlier, the General Assembly already intended to occupy the field. But even more, with House Bill 722, the General Assembly stated that local minimum wage laws shall not be preempted if they're in effect by August 28, 2015. They recognize the power of local cities and municipalities to pass local minimum wage ordinances at least until August 28, 2015.
How is that affected by Section 67 and whether or not it's valid or invalid or was invalidated?
Well, I think the same rationale applies. The General Assembly is acknowledging in passing House Bill 722 that 67 is unconstitutional and unenforceable. Otherwise, the grandfather provision of House Bill 722 would directly conflict with 67.
There's no prohibition that the legislature can't pass two laws that cover the same thing, and if it has done that in many occasions, and passing one does not necessarily mean that they believe the other was unconstitutional.
Sure, you're right about that, Chief Justice Breckenridge. The point of looking at the statutory scheme as a whole is really, it's the tertiary argument here. First, there's nothing in the express statutory language. Second, the legislative intent is to protect employees and not employers. And then finally, you get to the statutory interpretation and you look at it in whole and you think, why would the General Assembly act twice on the same subject if they had already done it the first time around?
Well, even if they decided to act twice, the more recent one, to the extent they're in conflict, the more recent one governs.
That's right. The court reads statutory schemes in harmony, and if there is a conflict, the more recent statute.
And is there a conflict between the two?
Between House Bill 722 and the minimum wage law?
And 671571.
If 67 was constitutional, which it's not, there would be a conflict. You're right. The grandfather provision of 722 would conflict with 67, and House Bill 722 would control.
You've challenged the constitution of Section 67 provision, but not of the new House Bill 722. Why is that? And does that make a difference?
The minimum wage ordinance was in effect by August 28, 2015, so it complies with House Bill 722. Therefore, it's not right. The city doesn't have a need to challenge House Bill 722. We complied with it.
So St. Louis is in a different position than Kansas City in our prior case because Kansas City did not have an ordinance in effect on August 28th, but your position is St. Louis did.
That's right, Judge Smith. The outcome of your Kansas City case does not affect the outcome of this case. St. Louis is in a different position than Kansas City.
There's a suggestion that the ordinance may have been in effect, but the requirements of the ordinance were not yet effective or had been implemented until sometime after August 28th. What's your response to that?
Well, the minimum wage under the ordinance hadn't increased because the city realized the practicalities of the situation that people needed time to get ramped up. But the ordinance had been passed and it was on the books. It was effective legislation by August 28, 2015.
Statute uses the word minimum wage ordinance requirements. It doesn't just say ordinance.
Well, the requirements had been passed. They were on the books. They were enforceable.
But were they in effect?
The requirements were in effect. The requirements were that the minimum wage would increase 3 months down the road.
But they didn't go into effect until after the override of the veto. It was in October, 30 days or so after the veto was overridden.
Well, the requirements of the minimum wage ordinance, is that what you're asking about?
Yes, the House Bill 722 is what I'm speaking of.
Okay, so House Bill 722 went into effect in,
October.
I think, October 16th. Mm-hmm. And the minimum wage ordinance was in effect on August 28th. So under any scenario, we complied with House Bill 722. Does that answer your question?
Were there any requirements that weren't in effect then, or was it just its application would... How do we read the fact that the minimum wage wouldn't actually rise till after August 28th? Does that mean its requirements were not in effect, or is that a different issue?
No, the requirements of the ordinance were in effect. The requirements said the minimum wage will increase in October, then it'll increase again in January, and then the following January and the following January. But the requirements were in effect. The ordinance was in full effect and enforceable. So under respondent's theory, a statute that prohibits conduct serves as an authorization for unregulated conduct on the same subject. That would result in every statute of prohibition conflicting with a local law on the same subject. For instance, under respondent's theory, if the General Assembly passed a statewide smoking ban that prohibited smoking in public places but exempted smoking in certain places like bars or pool halls, that would serve as an authorization to smoke in those places. If a local ordinance passed the same prohibition, but also included smoking in bars and pool halls, there would be a conflict between the two. That same fact pattern and argument were rejected by the court in Carlson when it held a statute of prohibition does not authorize conduct unless it is expressed in statutory language or evident from the statutory intent. Under respondent's theory, state law that criminalizes certain conduct and requires a mens rea element would conflict with a local law that criminalized that same conduct but set a lower standard by not requiring a mens rea element. That fact pattern and argument was rejected by this court in the LaRose case. Under respondent's argument, a state law that set election notice requirements, set a minimum for election notice requirements, would serve as authorization for any notice requirements that met that minimum. If a local law increased the minimum requirements, there would be a conflict. Again, that same fact pattern and argument were rejected by this court in the Maitland case. Under respondent's theory, if a state law set minimum bank capitalization requirements, that would serve to authorize any bank capitalization that met that requirement. If a local law were passed that increased those minimum requirements, there would be a conflict. That fact pattern and argument were rejected by the Court of Appeals in the Glassnap case. Respondents' argument contravenes what is near black letter law in the state of Missouri. They rely primarily on a 2001 trial court decision to support their case, which did not have the benefit of evaluating the complete statutory scheme after the House Bill 722 was passed, in which the General Assembly recognized local ordinances in effect by August 28, 2015 shall not be preempted. The General Assembly recognized local authority to pass these laws. They also rely on two older Supreme Court cases, the Klassmeyer case from 1908 and the Stetson case from 1960. Both of those cases were decided before the Missouri Constitution was amended to grant local municipalities home rule authority. After the Constitution provided local municipalities with home rule authority, as we currently have, courts have interpreted that provision to give cities all authority the General Assembly has to convey unless it conflicts with local laws. When the Klassmeyer and Stetson decisions were passed or handed down, at that point in time, the way courts construed it is that local municipalities had to have an express grant of authority to act. And so Klassmeyer and Stetson were decided under a completely different constitutional framework and constitutional authority than we have today. And if the court were to adopt that approach, it would be stepping back in time before cities were granted home rule authority as we currently have. Because there's no conflict between the minimum wage law and the ordinance in this case, the court's judgment on count one should be reversed. For the same reason, the court's judgment on count three should be reversed. The trial judge found that there was no authority for the city to act because there was a conflict between the minimum wage ordinance and the statewide minimum wage law. There is no conflict, thus the city had authority. Respondents also argue on appeal, as they did before the trial court, that the city is without authority because it exceeds matters of local concern. That argument was rejected by the trial court and should be rejected by this court as well. Essentially, respondents focus on the national scope of the problem caused by the minimum wage. That's a misguided approach. The correct approach is to look at whether the solution enacted in the ordinance and passed by the city is focused on local issues. That's exactly what we have here. The Board of Aldermen heard testimony and evaluated evidence, which is before this court. It's exhibits L through O. And as a result of that testimony and evidence about how these issues affect St. Louis uniquely, they adopted the ordinance, which contains findings to that effect.
What makes this, what distinguishes this from the foreclosure case, which we said was not a matter of purely local concern, or
sure,
was properly for statewide regulation?
Sure, I see I'm out of time, but can I answer that? First,
yes,
of all, in the Missouri Bankers case I think you're referring to, number one, the county conceded that there was a conflict between the ordinance and the state law. That was a concession at the outset, and that's not what you have here. And secondarily, the county conceded that the local law was passed in order to address national foreclosure issues, which is not what you have here. Here, this is essentially addressed to address cost of living issues, which is by definition going to be different in different areas of the state.
But the county did not concede its assertion of authority under the home rule charter for St. Louis County. St. Louis County thought that they should be able to regulate the foreclosures in their neighborhoods and St. Louis County.
They thought they did have that authority, but they were invoking that authority.
Section 18 or something.
Correct. The home rule authority. They were invoking that authority to address issues that they acknowledged were national issues. And here we're addressing issues that have to do with
the county laws, by the way.
That's right, because they essentially conceded the issue away. Here, the cost of living issues are, by definition, going to affect St. Louis different than they would Joplin or Cape Girardeau or Kirksville or even Kansas City. The cost of living is different and resources are different and workers are affected differently in those different geographies.
There are no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
The biggest problem I think that the city has with regard to HB 722 is they're sort of arguing out of both sides of their mouth. They're saying 722 authorized them. Well, there's a couple problems with that. One, if it is really an authorizer, then you do have a constitutional problem because the title of the bill says prohibited ordinances. It was very clear that the legislature was not authorizing, but if you accept their argument, then you do have a single subject original purpose title problem because they're authorizing a minimum wage but then prohibiting a minimum wage even under the title that says prohibited ordinances. So that's...
That may be, but nobody's challenging 722 in this case.
Right, but they are saying that it is an authorizer, and the problem with that is that when the ordinance was passed, that bill didn't exist to authorize their conduct. The city never responds to the whole line of argument that says that, look, you can't pass an ordinance when your authority hasn't yet not been enacted. So if they say that is an authorizer, then they run into that problem.
They did pass the ordinance, and then the legislature did pass HB 722, and it does say grandfathers in existing ordinances.
No, the timing was different. The bill was passed. The governor vetoed it at the behest of the city, at the request of the city, and then they passed the ordinance. There was no law on the books when that ordinance passed. Then the first raise was not going to take effect until after the legislative override and HB 22 became effective.
Was the ordinance in effect on August 28th?
Was the ordinance in effect?
Yeah.
I would argue no, because their argument is
that... Had it been adopted on August 28th by the city?
Yes, it was. It was voted and it was signed by the mayor.
Okay.
Yes.
Suppose the city had enacted an ordinance long before August 28th that said that the minimum wage in that city would be X and it would go up a quarter every January 1st forever.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that under House Bill 722, the minimum wage would be okay in that city, the local minimum wage would be all right, but it would freeze there and wouldn't go up any subsequent January?
If I understand your hypothetical correctly, that they passed an ordinance long before 722, well, I would argue that they wouldn't have not had authority to do that then.
Assume that doesn't carry the day.
Well, then I don't agree that 722 is an authorizer. I believe that they were grandfathering in what the city was already doing, and assuming, but that would have to assume, I mean, the hard part about your hypothetical is it takes away every legal argument why they never had authority to do it anyway.
Right. I agree with you. That's
so if 722 was the, because then you'd be really eradicating the whole chapter because, you know, for example, except as may otherwise be provided, effective January 1, 2007, every employer shall pay each employee wages at the rate of $6.50. It doesn't say every employer except those in the city of St. Louis.
And it doesn't prohibit people getting more. I'm confident you get more than $6.50 an hour, and I know I do. So.
Some days, I wonder, but yes, I will assume that.
Will you concede that language you just read should be interpreted to mean not less than?
No, I mean minimum. If you take
away,
it doesn't
say minimum. The word's not in there.
Well, it says it, but it doesn't require an express. If you cannot reconcile the two, that's when you get the conflict. And so, an employer cannot comply with state law and not be subject to criminal penalties in the city of St. Louis. That's the problem. They cannot comply with both. The minimum, and so I think that people recognize that because when the law was changed in 2006 or 7, 77% of Missourians agreed with the minimum wage increase. That was done on a statewide basis. And so I don't think that if you look at Section 2 of 295.02, it says the minimum wage. I mean, they do refer to it as minimum wage, and there can only be one minimum.
The provision that says the employer shall not pay, it says shall pay, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't say not less than.
Or wages at the same rate or rate set under the provisions of the federal law as the prevailing federal minimum wage applicable to those covered jobs. So, I mean, they refer to it as a minimum wage. The legislature is clear that that's what that is.
Okay.
And so I think 722 was passed in response to what the cities were doing. and it wasn't an authorizer. I think that language was inserted to save what was currently going on, but that's all that that was. And, I mean, if the legislature didn't want them to allow plastic bags or to ban plastic bags, they certainly weren't allowing however many local governmental bodies we have in the state of Missouri to hurry up and pass a minimum wage between May and August. And so, I think that's an unrealistic interpretation of the legislative goal, the legislative words, and the legislative scheme.
Your time is up.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. This case will be submitted.